James Penny, wanted for arson and criminal damage. He stared at the bulletin. It grew larger and larger. It grew life-size. His face stared back at him like he was looking in a mirror. James Penny, arson, criminal damage, all points bulletin. The woman in front of him finished her business, and he stepped forward to the head of the line. The desk sergeant looked up at him.
"Can I help you, sir?" he said.
Penny shook his head. He peeled off left and walked away, stepped calmly outside into the bright morning sun, and ran back north like a madman. He made about 100 yards before the heat slowed him to a gasping walk. Then he did the instinctive thing, which was to duck off the blacktop and take cover in a wild birch grove. He pushed through the brush until he was out of sight and collapsed into a sitting position, back against a thin, rough trunk, legs splayed out straight, chest heaving, hands clamped against his head like he was trying to stop it from exploding. Arson and criminal damage. He knew what the words meant, but he couldn't square them with what he had actually done. It was his own damn house to burn, like he was burning his trash. He was entitled. How could that be arson? A guy chooses to burn his own house down. How is that a crime? This is a free country, right? And he could explain anyway. He'd been upset. He sat slumped against the birch trunk and breathed easier, but only for a moment, because then he started thinking about lawyers. He'd had personal experience. His divorce had cost him plenty in lawyer bills. He knew what lawyers were like. Lawyers were the problem. Even if it wasn't arson, it was going to cost plenty in lawyer bills to start proving it. It was going to cost a steady torrent of dollars, pouring out for years, dollars he didn't have and never would have again. He sat there on the hard, dry ground and realized that absolutely everything he had in the whole world was right then in direct contact with his body. One pair of shoes, one pair of socks, one pair of boxers, Levi's, cotton shirt, leather jacket, and his billfold. He put his hand down and touched its bulk in his pocket. 6 weeks' pay, less yesterday's spending. 6 weeks' worth of his pay might buy about 6 hours of a lawyer's time. 6 hours, the guy might get as far as writing down his full name and address, maybe his date of birth. His social security number would take another 6. The actual nature of his problem, that would be in the 3rd 6-hour chunk, or the 4th. That was James Penny's experience with lawyers. He got to his feet in the clearing. His legs were weak with the lactic acid from the unaccustomed running. His heart was thumping. He leaned up against a birch trunk and took a deep breath, swallowed. He pushed back through the brush to the road, turned north, and started walking. He walked for a half hour, hands in his pockets, maybe 1.75 miles, and then his muscles eased off and his breathing calmed down. He began to see things clearly. he began to understand. He began to appreciate the power of labels. He was a realistic guy, and he always told himself the truth. He was an arsonist, because they said he was. The angry phase was over. Now it was about taking sensible decisions, one after the other. Clearing up the confusion was beyond his resources, so he had to stay out of their reach. That was his first decision. That was the starting point. That was the strategy. The other decisions would flow out of that. They were tactical. He could be traced three ways: by his name, by his face, by his car. He ducked sideways off the road again, into the trees, pushed 20 yards into the woods, kicked a shallow hole in the leaf mold, and stripped out of his billfold everything with his name on. He buried it all in the hole and stamped the earth flat. Then he took his beloved Firebird keys from his pocket and hurled them far into the trees. He didn't see where they fell. The car itself was gone. In the circumstances, that was good, but it had left a trail. It might have been seen in Mojave, outside the bank. It might have been seen at the gas stations where he filled it, and its plate number was on the motel form from last night with his name. A trail, arrowing north through California in neat little increments. He remembered his training from Vietnam. He remembered the tricks. If you wanted to move east from your foxhole, first you moved west. You moved west for a couple hundred yards, stepping on the occasional twig, brushing the occasional bush, until you had convinced Charlie you were moving west, as quietly as you could, but not quietly enough. Then you turned about and came back east, really quietly, doing it right, past your original starting point, and away. He'd done it a dozen times. His original plan had been to head north for a spell, maybe into Oregon. He'd gotten a few hours into that plan. Therefore, the Red Firebird had laid a modest trail north, so now he was going to turn south for a while and disappear. He walked back out of the woods, into the dust on the near side of the road, and started walking back the way he'd come. His face he couldn't change. It was right there on all the posters. He remembered it staring out at him from the bulletin board in the police building, the neat side parting, the sunken gray cheeks. He ran his hands through his hair, vigorously, back and forward, until it stuck out every which way. No more neat side parting. He ran his palms over 24 hours of stubble, decided to grow a big beard. No option, really. He didn't have a razor, and he wasn't about to spend any money on one. He walked on through the dust, heading south, with Excelsior Mountain towering up on his right. Then he came to the turn, dodging west toward San Francisco, through Tioga Pass, before Mount Dana reared up even higher. He stopped in the dust on the side of the road and pondered. Keeping on south would take him nearly all the way back to Mojave, too close to home, way too close. He wasn't comfortable about that, not comfortable at all. So he figured a new move. He'd head west to the coast, then decide. He put himself 30 yards west of the turn and stuck out his thumb. He was a practical guy. He knew he wasn't going to get anywhere by walking. He had to get rides, one after the other, anonymous rides from busy people. He decided, as a matter of tactics, not to look for rides from solid citizens, not from anybody who looked like they might notice him or remember him. He had to think like a fugitive, a whole new experience. After 40 minutes, he came up with an ironic grin and realized he didn't have to worry about avoiding the solid citizens. They were avoiding him. He was standing there, thumb out, no baggage, messy hair, unshaven, dusty up to the knees, and one vehicle after another was passing him right by, glancing at him and accelerating down the road like he wasn't even there. The sun wheeled overhead and dropped away into afternoon, and he started to worry about getting a ride at all. He was hungry and thirsty and vulnerable, alone and on foot in the exact middle of the hugest and most contemptuous landscape he had ever seen. Salvation arrived in the form of an open-topped Jeep, dusty and dented, a sandy color that really wasn't any color at all. A guy about 40 at the wheel, long graying hair, dirty tie-dye shirt, some kind of a leftover hippie. The Jeep slowed and plowed into the dust, stopped right next to Penny, and the driver leaned over inside and shouted across over the throb of the worn muffler.
"I'm going to Sacramento, my friend," he said, "but if you want the bay, I can let you off in Stockton."
Penny shook his head vigorously.
"Sacramento is great," he shouted. "Thank you very much."
He put his right hand on the windshield frame and his left hand on the seat back and swung himself inside, exactly like he'd done with jeeps in Vietnam.
"You just lay back and look at the scenery, my friend,"
the driver shouted over the muffler noise.
"Talking is not an option in this old thing. Too loud, you know what I mean?"
James Penny nodded gratefully at him, and the old hippie let in the clutch and roared off down the road. The Laney County Medical Examiner's office was just that, an office, and a fairly rudimentary one. There were no facilities for post-mortem examination unless Kolek wanted to clear his own desk and slice the carbonized lump open all over it. So he had taken the body bag down to the facility the county used over in northern Los Angeles. It was a big modern morgue, well-equipped and busy. It was busy because it sucked in all the business from the ring of small counties surrounding it, as well as handling its own substantial quota of unfortunates. So Kolek had parked the bag in the cold store and signed up for the first free visitor slot of the day, which was mid-afternoon. It was a half-hour slot, but Kolek figured that was going to be more than long enough. Not a hell of a lot of doubt about how Penny had died. All that was left was a routine ID through the dental data. Laney itself had one dentist, serving the population of 2,000 people. He had never seen Penny, but he was reasonably new, and the sheriff said it wasn't unusual for Laney people to forget about their teeth. The factory gave health insurance, of course, but not the best in the world, and dentistry required a contribution. But the surgery nurse was a stout old woman who had been there through three separate tenures. She went through the system and found the Penny file, where it had been stored after his last visit 12 years before. It was a thin packet of notes and film in a buff envelope. Kolek signed for it and threw it into the back seat of his wagon, checked his watch, and headed south for the morgue. James Penny got out of the old hippie's jeep, right on the main drag into the southern edge of Sacramento, wind-blown, tired, ears ringing from the noise. He stood by the side of the road and waved and watched the guy go, waving back, long gray hair blowing in the slipstream. Then he looked around in the sudden silence and took his bearings. All the way up and down the drag, he could see a forest of signs, bright colors, neon, advertising motels, air and pool and cable, burger places, eateries of every description, supermarkets, auto parts. Looked like the kind of place a guy could get lost in, no trouble at all. Big choice of motels, all side by side, all competing, all offering the lowest prices in town. He walked down to level with three of them, figured he'd use the middle one, hole up and plan ahead. But then he decided to try something he'd read about once in a travel guide. Check in late and ask for an even lower price. Late in the day, the motel would be keen to rent another room. They'd figure something is better than nothing, right? That was the theory in the travel guide. It was a theory he'd never tried, but now was the time to start. So he went straight out for a late lunch, or an early dinner, or whatever it was time for. He chose a burger chain he'd never used before and sat in the window, idly watching the traffic. The waitress came over, and he ordered a cheeseburger and two Cokes. He was dry from the dust on the road. The 40-year-old leftover hippie with the long graying hair drove on downtown and parked the dusty and dented Jeep right up against a hydrant outside the Sacramento Police Department's main building. He pulled the keys and stepped out. Stood and stretched in the warmth of the afternoon sun before ducking inside. The Drug Enforcement Agency's Sacramento office was located in a suite of rooms lent to them by the police department. The only way in was through the precinct hall, past the desk sergeants. Agents had to sign in and out. They had to collect internal ID badges to wear inside the building, and they had to leave them there on their way out. Two reasons for that. They tended to look more like criminals than agents, and the badges kept confusion inside the station house to a minimum. And, because they were working undercover, they couldn't afford to slip their IDs into their pockets, absent-mindedly or by mistake, and walk out like that. If they did, and they got searched by whatever new friends they were trying to make, there could be some very bad consequences. So the strict rule was the IDs stayed at the precinct house desk every moment the agents weren't actually inside and wearing them. The 40-year-old hippie lined up to sign in and collect his badge. He was behind a couple of uniforms with some guy in handcuffs. One desk sergeant on duty. A wait. He scanned the bulletins on the back wall. High risk of forest fire, missing children. Then a face stared out at him, an APB teletype. James Penny, Laney, California, arson and criminal damage.
Shit,
he said, loudly. The desk sergeant and the cops with the cuffed guy all turned to look at him.
That guy, he said, James Penny. I just drove him all the way over here through the mountains.
The sheriff in Laney took the call from Sacramento. He was busy closing out the files on the previous day's activity. The DWIs, the broken windows, the smashed windshield, the small stuff. The Penny file was already in the drawer, just waiting for Kolak's formal ID to tie it up.
Penny?
He said to the Sacramento desk sergeant.
No, he's dead. Crashed and burned on the road out to Vegas last night.
Then he hung up. But he was a conscientious guy, and cautious, so he found the number for the morgue down in L.A. He was stretching his hand out for the phone when it rang again. It was Kolak, calling on his mobile, straight from the dissecting table.
What?
The sheriff asked, although he already knew what from Kolek's voice. Two main problems, Kolak said. The teeth are nowhere near. Penny had a bridge across the front, cheap dentures. These are real teeth.
And?
The sheriff asked.
What else?
This is a woman, Kolak said. Penny had finished his meal in the Sacramento Burger Shack when he saw the four police cruisers arrive. He had a dollar on the table for the waitress and was getting up ready to leave. He had actually lifted off the sticky vinyl bench and was sliding out sideways when he caught sight of them. Four cruisers, playing leapfrog along the strip of motels. The cops were going into each office in turn, a sheaf of papers in their hands, coming out, sliding along to the next office. Penny sat back down, stared out at them through the window, watched them leapfrog south until they were out of sight. Then he stood up and left, turned up the collar on his leather jacket, and walked north, not quickly, not slowly, holding his breath. The Laney sheriff was on the phone. He had tracked Penny to his bank. He was aware of the big cash withdrawal yesterday. He had looked at the road on the map, Laney to Mojave, and he'd guessed correctly about the northward dash along the flank of Mount Whitney. He'd called gas stations, one after the other, working north through the phone book, until he found a pump jockey who remembered a red Firebird whose driver had paid from a thick wad of cash. Then he'd done some mental arithmetic, speed and distance and time, and started calling a thin cluster of motels in the area he figured Penny had reached at the end of the day. Second number, he'd found the right place, the Pine Park Holiday Motel up near Yosemite. Penny had checked in at about 9 o'clock, car and all, name and plate number right there on the desk guy's carbon. Beyond that, there was no further information. The sheriff called the nearest police department 10 miles south of the motel. No report of a stolen Firebird. No other missing automobiles. No knowledge of a woman car thief in the locality. So the sheriff called the Mojave General Motors dealership and asked for the value of an 18-month-old Firebird, clean, low mileage. He added that amount to the bank's figure for the cash withdrawal. Penny had rendezvoused at the motel and sold his car to the dead woman, and was on the run with nearly 15 grand in his pants pocket. A lot of money. It was clear, obvious. Penny had planned and prepared. The sheriff opened his map again. The Sacramento sighting had been just plain luck, so now was the time to capitalize on it. He wouldn't be aiming to stay there. Too small, state capital, too well policed. So he'd be moving on, probably up to the wilds of Oregon or Washington State or Idaho or Montana. But not by plane, not with cash. Paying cash for an air ticket out of a California city is the same thing as begging to be arrested for narcotics trafficking, so he'd be aiming to get out by road. But Sacramento was a city with an ocean not too far away to the left and high mountains to the right. Fundamentally, 6 roads out was all. So 6 roadblocks would do it, maybe on a 10-mile radius, so the local commuters wouldn't get snarled up. The sheriff nodded to himself and picked up the phone to call the highway patrol. It started raining in Sacramento at dusk. Steady, wetting rain. Northern California, near the mountains. Very different from what Penny was used to. He was hunched in his jacket, head down, walking north, trying to decide if he dared hitch a ride. The police cruisers at the motel strip had unsettled him. He was tired and demoralized and alone, and wet, and conspicuous. Nobody walked anywhere in California. He glanced over his shoulder at the traffic stream and saw a dull olive Chevrolet sedan slowing behind him. It came to a stop, and a long arm stretched across and opened the passenger door. The dome light clicked on and shone on the soaked roadway.
"Want a ride?" the driver called.
Penny ducked down and glanced inside. The driver was a very tall man, about 30, muscular, built like a regular weightlifter. Short fair hair, rugged open face. Dressed in uniform, army uniform. Penny read the insignia and registered military police captain. He glanced at the dull olive paint on the car and saw a white serial number stenciled on the flank.
"I don't know," he said.
"Get in out of the rain," the driver said. "A vet like you knows better than to walk in the rain, right?"
Penny slid inside, closed the door.
"How do you know I'm a vet?"
he asked.
"The way you walk," the driver said, "and your age, and the way you look. Guy your age looking like you look and walking in the rain didn't beat the draft for college, that's for damn sure."
Penny nodded.
"No, I didn't,"
he said.
"I did a jungle tour 17 years ago."
"So let me give you a ride," the driver said. "A favor, one soldier to another. Consider it a veteran's benefit."
Okay,
Penny said. Where are you headed? The driver asked.
I don't know,
Penny said.
North, I guess.
Okay, north it is, the driver said. I'm Jack Reacher. Pleased to make your acquaintance. Penny said nothing. You got a name? The guy called Reacher asked. Penny hesitated.
I don't know,
he said. Reacher put the car in drive and glanced over his shoulder, eased back into the traffic stream, clicked the switch, and locked the doors. What did you do? He asked.
Do?
Penny repeated. You're running, Reacher said, heading out of town, walking in the rain, head down, no bag, don't know what your name is. I've seen a lot of people running, and you're one of them.
You gonna turn me in?
I'm a military cop, Reacher said. You done anything to hurt the army?
The army?
Penny said.
No, I was a good soldier.
So why would I turn you in? Penny looked blank.
I don't know,
he said. What did you do to the civilians? Reacher asked.
You're gonna turn me in,
Penny said helplessly. Reacher shrugged at the wheel. Well, that depends, he said. What did you do? Penny said nothing. Reacher turned his head and looked straight at him, a powerful, silent stare, hypnotic intensity in his eyes, held for 100 yards of road. What did you do? He asked again. Penny couldn't look away. He took a breath.
I burned my house, he said, near Mojave. I worked 17 years and got canned yesterday, and I got all upset because they were going to take my car away, so I burned my house. And they're calling it deliberate arson.
Near Mojave, Reacher said. They would. They don't like fires down there. Penny nodded.
I should have thought harder, but I was real mad. 17 years, and suddenly I'm shit on their shoe. And my car got stolen anyway, first night I'm away.
There are roadblocks all around here, Reacher said. I came through one south of the city.
You think they're for me?
Penny asked. Could be, Reacher said. They don't like fires down there.
You gonna turn me in?
Reacher looked at him again, hard and silent. Is that all you did? Penny nodded.
Yes, sir. That's all I did.
There was silence for a beat, just the sound of the wet pavement under the tires. Well, I don't have a problem with it. Reacher said. A guy does a jungle tour, works 17 years and gets canned. I guess he's entitled to get a little mad.
So what should I do?
You got attachments?
Divorce, no kids.
So start over, someplace else.
They'll find me,
Penny said. You're already thinking about changing your name, Reacher said. Penny nodded.
I junked all my ID,
he said.
Buried it in the woods.
So build a new identity. Get new paper. That's all anybody cares about. Pieces of paper.
Like how?
Reacher was quiet another beat, thinking hard. Easy enough, he said. Classic way is find some cemetery. Find a kid who died as a child. Get a copy of the birth certificate. Start from there. Get a social security number, a passport, credit cards, and you're a new person. Penny shrugged.
I can't do all that. Too difficult. And I don't have time. According to you, there's a roadblock up ahead. How am I going to do all of that stuff before we get there?
There are other ways, Reacher said.
Forgeries?
Reacher shook his head. No good. Sooner or later, forgeries don't work.
So how?
Find some guy who's already created false ID for himself and take it away from him. Penny shook his head.
You're crazy. How am I going to do that?
Maybe you don't need to do that. Maybe I already did it for you.
You got false ID?
Not me, Reacher said. Guy I was looking for.
What guy?
Reacher drove one-handed and pulled a sheaf of official paper from his inside jacket pocket. Arrest warrant, he said. Army liaison officer at a weapons plant outside of Fresno looks to be peddling blueprints. turns out to have three separate sets of bogus ID, all perfect, all completely backed up with everything from elementary school records onward, which makes it likely they're Soviet, which means they can't be beat. I'm on my way back from talking to him right now. He was running, too, already on his second set of papers. I took them. They're clean. They're in the trunk of this car, in a wallet, in a jacket. Traffic was slowing ahead. There was red glare visible through the streaming windshield, flashing blue lights, yellow flashlight beams waving side to side. "There's the roadblock," Reacher said.
"So, can I use this guy's ID?"
Penny asked urgently. "Sure you can," Reacher said. "Hop out and get it. Bring the wallet from the jacket." He slowed and stopped on the shoulder. Penny got out, ducked away to the back of the car, and lifted the trunk lid. Came back a long moment later, white in the face. "Got it?" Reacher asked. Penny nodded silently, held up the wallet. "It's all in there," Reacher said. "I checked. Everything anybody needs." Penny nodded again. "So, put it in your pocket," Reacher said. Penny slipped the wallet into his inside jacket pocket. Reacher's right hand came up. There was a gun in it, and a pair of handcuffs in his left. "Now, sit still," he said quietly. He leaned over and snapped the cuffs on Penny's wrists, one-handed, put the car back into drive, and crawled forward.
"What's this for?"
Penny asked. "Quiet," Reacher said. They were two cars away from the checkpoint. Three highway patrolmen in rain capes were directing traffic into a corral formed by parked cruisers. Their light bars were flashing bright in the shiny dark.
"What?"
Penny said again. Reacher said nothing, just stopped where the cop told him and wound his window down. The night air blew in, cold and wet. The cop bent down. Reacher handed him his military ID. The cop played his flashlight over it and handed it back.
"Who's your passenger?"
he asked. "My prisoner," Reacher said. He handed over the arrest warrant.
"He got ID?"
the cop asked. Reacher leaned over and slipped the wallet out from inside Penny's jacket, two-fingered like a pickpocket, flipped it open and passed it through the window. A second cop stood in Reacher's headlight beams and copied the plate number onto a clipboard, stepped around the hood and joined the first guy.
"Captain Reacher of the military police,"
the first cop said. The second cop wrote it down.
"With a prisoner name of Edward Hendricks,"
the first cop said. The second cop wrote it down.
"Thank you, sir,"
the first cop said.
"You drive safe now."
Reacher eased out from between the cruisers, accelerated away into the rain. A mile later, he stopped again on the shoulder, leaned over and unlocked Penny's handcuffs, put them back in his pocket. Penny rubbed his wrists.
I thought you were going to turn me in," he said.
Reacher shook his head. "Look better for me that way. I've got an arrest warrant. I want a prisoner in the car for everybody to see, right?" Penny nodded.
"I guess,"
he said quietly. Reacher handed the wallet back. "Keep it," he said.
"Really?"
"Edward Hendricks," Reacher said. "That's who you are now, rest of your life. It's clean ID, and it'll work. Think of it like a veteran's benefit. One soldier to another, okay?" Edward Hendricks looked at him and nodded and opened his door, got out into the rain and turned up the collar of his leather jacket and started walking north. Reacher watched him until he was out of sight and then pulled away and took the next turn west, turned north past a town called Eureka and stopped again where the road was lonely and ran close to the ocean. There was a wide gravel shoulder and a low barrier and a steep cliff with the Pacific high tide boiling and foaming 50 feet below it. He got out of the car and opened the trunk and grasped the lapels of the jacket he had told his passenger about, took a deep breath, and heaved. The corpse was heavy. He wrestled it up out of the trunk and jacked it onto his shoulder and staggered with it to the barrier, bent his knees, and dropped it over the edge. The rocky cliff caught it, and it spun, and the arms and the legs flailed limply. Then it hit the surf with a faint splash, and it was gone. Everyone talks.
There are written rules and unwritten rules, and I hit one of each on my first day in the department. The unwritten rule said the new detective got the worst job, which on that morning was to follow a written rule. City hospitals were required to report gunshot victims, and the department was required to investigate. Boring work, and likely fruitless. But rules were rules. Times two for a woman in a man's world. So off I went. I got the worst car, obviously, with no GPS on the dash and no maps in the glove box, but I found the hospital easily enough. It was a large beige building southeast of downtown. I showed my shiny new shield and was directed to the fifth floor. Not exactly the ICU, they said, but the same kind of thing. A big enough deal that I had to turn off my phone. A nurse met me there and took me to a doctor who had threads of silver in her hair and looked like brains and money. She said I had wasted a trip. The victim was asleep and wasn't going to wake up any time soon because he was sedated with a custom mix that sounded pretty good to me. But I was new and I had a report to write, so I asked for her perspective. "Gunshot wound," she said, like I was slow in the head. "In the left side, up under the arm. Broke a rib and tore some muscle. Not very nice. Hence the painkillers." "Caliber?" I asked. "No idea," she said. "Not a BB gun, anyway." I asked to see the guy. "You want to watch him sleep? I have a report to write." She was cautious about infection, but she let me look in through a window. I saw a guy fast asleep on a cot. A very distinctive guy. Short, messy hair, plain features. He was on his back. The sheet was down at his hips. He was naked from the waist up. He had a pressure dressing high on his left side. He had tubes in the back of his hand and a clip on his finger. I could see a sinus rhythm on his monitor. It was beeping away, strong and powerful, as it should, because the guy was huge, almost bigger than the cot itself. He was easily 6'5 and 250. A giant, hands like catcher's mitts, a slab of a man. He was ridged with muscle. Not old, but not young either. He looked worn and battered. He had scars here and there. A big old thing low down on his gut, like a huge white starfish with thick, crude stitches. An old bullet hole in his chest. A 38, almost certainly. An eventful life. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. He looked to be sleeping quite peacefully. I asked, "Any idea what happened?" "Probably not self-inflicted," the doctor said, "unless he's a contortionist." "I mean, didn't he tell you anything?" "He came in conscious, but he didn't say a word." I asked, "Did he have ID?" His stuff is in a bag, the doctor said, at the nurse's station. It was a very small bag, clear plastic, with a zipper, like people use in the airport line. At the bottom was loose change, a couple of bucks. There was a wad of folding money, a couple of hundred possibly. Maybe more, it would depend on the denominations. There was an ATM card and a creased old passport, and finally a travel toothbrush, reversed for a pocket, with the bristles inside a plastic tube. "Is that it?" I asked. "You think we're stealing from our patients?" "Mind if I take a look?" I said. "You're the cop," the doctor said. The ATM card was made out to J. Reacher. It had another year to run. The passport had expired 3 years previously. It was made out to Jack Reacher, not John. Jack must have been on his birth certificate. No middle name, which was unusual in America. The photograph showed an approximate version of the face on the pillow. It was 13 years younger, and animated with an expression halfway between patient and impatient, as if the guy was prepared to give the photographer the time he needed, but not a second longer. No driver's license, no credit cards, no cell phone. I asked, "What was he wearing?" "Cheap things," the doctor said. "We burned them." "Why?" "Biohazard. I've seen better clothes on bums in the park." "Is he a transient?" "I told you he didn't say a word. He could be an eccentric billionaire for all I know." "He looks in good shape." "You mean apart from being bandaged up in a hospital bed?" "I mean generally. Healthy as a horse. Strong as a horse." "When will he wake up?" "Well, tonight, maybe. I dosed him like a horse, too." I went back at the end of my shift. Unpaid, but I was new and I wanted to make a good impression. There had been nothing on the wires about a shooting incident. No rumors, no other victims, no witnesses, no 911 calls, which I gathered was not unusual. The city was like that. The underbelly had a life of its own. Like Vegas. What happened there stayed there. I spent some time with the databases, too. Reacher was not a common name, and I figured the Jack-Nun-Reacher combination was likely to be much less common, but there was no real data. Or to put it the other way, all the data was negative. The guy had no phone, no car, no boat, no trailer, no credit history, no home, and no insurance. No nothing. There were some military records from way back. He had been an army cop, mostly in the Criminal Investigation Division. An officer, decorated multiple times, which at first gave me a warm fellow feeling, and then it worried me. 13 years honorable service, and now he was homeless, getting shot in the side, wearing clothes so toxic the hospital had to incinerate them? Not what a new detective wants to hear on her first day on the job. It was dark when I got back to the hospital, but up on the fifth floor I found the big guy awake. I knew his name, so I introduced myself to balance things up, to be polite. I told him I had a report to write. I told him it was required. I asked him what had happened. He said, "I don't remember." Which was plausible. Physical trauma can induce retrograde amnesia, but I didn't believe it. I got the feeling he was giving me a rote answer. I began to see why his file was so thin. A person has to work hard to stay under the radar. Which was okay with me, to be honest. I got my promotion because I'm a good interrogator, and I like a challenge. An old boyfriend said I should have it on my gravestone. Everyone talks. I said, "Help me out here." He looked back at me with clear blue eyes. Whatever painkiller cocktail they were using wasn't doing him any harm in the cognition department. His gaze was unworried and friendly, but also bleak and dangerous, wise and primitive, warm and predatory. I got the feeling he knew 100 ways to help me and 100 ways to kill me. I said, "I'm new on the job. Today is my first day. I'm going to get my butt kicked if I don't deliver." "Which would be a shame," he said, "because it's a very cute butt." Which would have gotten him sensitivity training on the job, but I couldn't take offense. He was lying there wounded and helpless, half naked, radiating a lazy kind of charm. "You were a cop," I said. "I saw your file. You worked in a team. Did you ever save someone's ass?" "Time to time," he said. "So save mine now." He said nothing. "How did it start?" "It's late," he said. "Don't you have a home to go to?" "Don't you?" He didn't answer. "How did it start?" I asked again. He sighed and took a breath and said it started like things usually start, which was to say they usually don't start at all. He said most places he went were peaceful and quiet. He said most places, nothing happens. I asked him what he meant. He said big cities, small towns, he went about his business and nobody knew. He said he ate his meals and slept and showered and changed and saw what he saw. Sometimes he got lucky with an hour's conversation. Sometimes he got lucky with a night's companionship. But mostly nothing happened. He said he had a quiet life. He said he could go months between days worth forgetting. But if it was going to happen, it was going to start with people. Usually with people in bars or diners or restaurants. Places where food and drink is consumed and where a certain kind of community is expected. And where sipping and chewing make people unembarrassed about not talking, because no one ever says anything. They look, instead. It was all about the looking away, to be precise. There can be a guy people are looking away from, maybe alone at the bar, or alone in a diner booth, or at a restaurant table. People are partly shunning him, but mostly they're scared of him. Some kind of a bully, unpopular, and he knows it. He knows people go quiet around him, and he knows they look away, and he loves it. He loves the power. "Is that how it started?" I asked. "Yesterday?" Reacher nodded. "There was a guy in a bar." Reacher didn't know the bar. He wasn't part of that community. He had never been in the city before. He had ridden the big dog all day and gotten out at the depot 2 blocks from First Street. He had walked over and found the bar. Not hard. That close to the depot, it was about the only game in town. He had walked in and taken a seat. He had figured he would rely on waitress service. He didn't want to belly up to the mahogany. He didn't want to get face to face with the barman. He wasn't looking for any kind of witty small talk. I said, "Back up a minute. You came in on the Greyhound bus?" He nodded. He had told me that already. I saw the same look on his face, like in his passport photograph, patient to a degree, but he wanted the world to keep up with him. I asked, "Where were you coming from?" He said, "Does it matter?" "Why were you coming here?" "I have to be somewhere. I thought this place would be as good as any." "For what?" "For passing a day or two, or an hour or two." The records show you have no permanent location. Then the records are correct, which is reassuring, I suppose, from your point of view. What happened in the bar? He sighed again and took another breath and went on with the story quite candidly. My interrogation mojo was working, or maybe the painkiller cocktail was acting like a truth serum. He said the place was busy, but he had gotten a seat with his back to a wall, so he could see the room and both its doors all at once. An old habit. Military cops do a lot of their work in bars. The waitress had scooted over and taken his order. He had asked for coffee and settled for beer, Rolling Rock, in a bottle. He was no kind of connoisseur. He was happy to take what places had to offer. Then he had watched the man at the bar. He was a heavy-limbed guy, tall, with dark, vivid features, sitting there commandingly and complacently, with everyone else looking away from him. Reacher defaulted to his instinctive position, which was to hope for the best, but plan for the worst. And the worst, with a guy like that, wouldn't be too bad. He would come off the stool into a yard of clear space. There would be a certain amount of huffing and puffing. Bullies got by on reputation alone, and the worse the reputation, the less practice they got in actually doing anything, because other people always backed off. Therefore, a bully's skills were rusty and eroded. A simple cigarette punch would take care of the problem, named way back in the day when everyone smoked. A guy's mouth would open, ready to load the next cigarette between his lips, an insolent and calculated little pause, maybe half a smile, and a vicious left uppercut under the chin, timed just right, would slam his mouth shut again, busting teeth, maybe making him bite through his tongue. Game over, right there. And if it wasn't, then a clubbing downward right to the side of the neck would close the deal, like driving a railroad spike with your knuckles. No major problem, except that no one smoked anymore, at least not indoors, so you had to do it while they were talking, which was okay because everyone talked. Bullies, most of all. They talked a lot. All kinds of threats and taunts and, what are you looking at? But hope for the best. Reacher sipped the watery foam from his long-neck bottle and waited. The waitress was in a lull and came over to ask if he needed anything, which was clearly an excuse to chat a moment. Reacher liked her on sight. Maybe she liked him, too. She was a professional, maybe 40 years old. Not a college kid, not a young person planning to move on soon to something better. She was looking away from the guy, too. His needs were being met by the barman, and she seemed very glad about that. It was more than obvious. "Who is he?" Reacher asked. "Just a customer," she said. "Does he have a name?" "Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure he has a name, but I don't know what it is." Which Reacher didn't believe. Guy like that, everyone knows his name, because a guy like that makes sure of it. Reacher asked, "Does he come here often?" "Once a week, every week." Which was a strangely precise schedule, which had to mean something. But the woman didn't want to talk about it. That was clear. She started in with the usual questions instead. "New in town? From where? Doing what?" Which were questions Reacher found hard to answer. He was always new in town, and he was from nowhere in particular, and he wasn't doing anything. He had been in the military all his life, first an officer's kid, then an officer himself, raised on bases all over the world, serving on bases all over the world. And then he had fallen out into civilian life and couldn't really settle down to the kind of existence normal people seemed to have. So he wandered the land, seeing the things he had never had time to see before, going here, going there, staying a night or two, and then moving on. No bags, no schedule, no plan. Travel light, travel far. At first he had expected to work it out of his system, but he had long ago given up on that ambition. He said, "Anyway, how's business here?" The waitress shrugged and made a shape with her mouth and said business was okay, but she didn't sound convinced. And waitresses knew they had a close-up view, better than accountants or auditors or analysts. They saw the sad expression on the owner's face exactly once a week on payday, which had to mean something, too. The only bar near the bus depot should have been doing a roaring trade.